You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Anytime the conversation turns to bicyclists and motorists sharing the road, it never seems to go that well. As more cyclists hit the streets these days, as commuters or recreational riders, the possibility for conflict with cars seems greater than ever. The two sides aren't afraid to speak their minds against each other. But according to our next guest, today's debate about bikes on roads is not a new one. Throughout history, bikes and vehicles, from horse-drawn carriages to the cars of today, have always been at odds on the road. But as today's bike boom continues, shows no signs of slowing down in coming years, is there a solution that can make the road work for everyone? Here with us now is James Longhurst. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse, and the author of Bike Battles, A History of Sharing the American Road. James, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
So when you're talking about bike battles, what kind of things are we talking about over the decades?
Well, one thing I'm not talking about is sort of the language we have right now about the war of cars versus bikes. And that's not what I meant when I came up with the title for the book. What I really wanted to talk about was battles over bikes, when governments, particularly on the city and the state level, for the last century and a half, have made decisions about what role bikes were going to have in transportation and in recreation and commuting. And so it's really a book that's about battles over the bike and battles over how we design the city as a place we live and work at the same time.
And at a big point of your book, it seems, is that other kind of bike battle, the daily conflict between car and bicyclist, is set on a landscape, on a turf, that was established over that history and all these little decisions, sometimes big decisions, over how we build our infrastructure.
Yeah, and it's definitely the curse of the historian is most normal people can wander through their lives and see the landscape around them and sort of assume either that things were always this way or that they were intended to be this way. And historians can, through really getting immersed in the sources from the past, see how very different either the past was just a mere couple of decades ago or how different it was intended to be. And the road as we have it now, as largely the province of automobiles and of personal automobiles, that's a very recent creation. And the design of the streets as we have them, the intersections, the signage, the laws, the rules of the road, as it were, are incredibly recent creations. And it's easy when we have debates today about what is the bicycle and what is its role in transportation to assume that things were always the way that we see them now. And that's really not the case.
Well, let's go back to the dawn of time as it regards bicycles anyway. What were some of those first debates and decisions that had to be made even before we were talking about, you know, internal combustion engines powering vehicles on the road?
Well, that's one of the things that in your introduction I was thinking about immediately, because you started by talking about bicycles and vehicles. And that's one of the first bicycle battles I talk about in the book, is that vehicles are a legal category. And it's a word we recognize, but it's also something that lawyers use to write laws to control and regulate. And the word vehicle has a legal definition, and it's something that existed long before the internal combustion vehicle. And when the bicycle first came along, the first fight was about, is this new technology, is this new way of getting around, does it fit in that category of legal vehicle? And that was a very high-stakes debate. And this is, we're talking really in the 1870s and 1880s, and these are bicycles that you and I would be a little terrified to see. These are things called the penny farthing or the ordinary or the high wheel. And a lot of the time in those decades, they were just called the wheel because they were an enormous front wheel, terrifying, no brakes, really only to be operated by young men and other human beings without common sense. And when these things started getting into trouble on the roads, they started going faster, causing accidents or causing injury. This became the first bike battle to come before the courts. And this is one of the first realizations I had, was that the courts and political institutions before them had a definition of what the road was as a commons, as a shared public resource, that there were, in fact, before the automobile, and in fact, now with the automobile, the road is a common pool resource that is used by many, many unalike road users, pedestrians, public transit, bicycles, personal automobiles, motorcycles, mopeds, segways, Prius and electric vehicles, and my goodness, soon autonomous vehicles, but also in the past, trolleys and omnibuses and hacks and carriages. And the road has existed in law for centuries and even millennia as a commons. And it's this first, when the bicycle comes along, the legal question is, will it be allowed into the commons as an equal user, or does it create a nuisance for other users that should eliminate it? And in fact, in those first debates in the 1870s and 1880s, the bicycle is included in the list of legal vehicles, and it's included in the list of legal vehicles before the automobile ever exists, and in ways that set legal precedent for the automobile to be added as a vehicle later.
Now, before we move on from that era, I've got to ask you to tell the story of Absalom Wyckoff, a pre-car, a horse and buggy rider, horse and wagon rider, who really didn't like these bikes.
And this is a story out of Chicago, and I still can't tell for the life of me. This is a newspaper story from the Chicago Daily Tribune, and I still can't tell if this journalist was reporting truth as he saw it, or spinning a bit of a parable about many different conflicts that they saw on the road. And this is a farmer. He is on the dirt roads of the time, and he has a great antipathy towards cyclists, and he declares that he's going to whip them in when he sees them. And he just happens to horsewhip the wrong cyclist, who dismounts, lays his bike down neatly, jumps up, takes away the whip, and becomes whipping Farmer Absalom. And it's told as a parable, as if the farmer at the end has been taught his lesson. But I found it as one of many stories where different road users order each other out of the road, to they declare each other to be unfair impositions on the public trust or the public good. And I found countless newspaper stories about farmers producing sawed-off shotguns and pointing them at automobile drivers and yelling, "Now stop tooting, dang ye," at people who are honking at them too much. And this is evidence. This might be disturbing, and it might be sort of evidence that we've always fought over the road. But it's evidence to me, as a historian, that what we have here is actually a very important debate over the public good and who has fair claim onto this resource, this shared resource of the road.
Talking to James Longhurst from UW La Crosse about his new book, Bike Battles, A History of Sharing the American Road. Well, there have been efforts to make that resource a little less scarce over the years, James. Obviously, a lot more roads than there were 150 years ago. And bikes, as I understand it from your book, were part of the, and bikers, bicyclists, were part of the impetus to pave roads and actually try to get a network of paved bike paths around the country.
And there's actually two different movements here as we move from the first terrifying high wheel to the bicycle that you and I would recognize and we could even ride if we were transported to the 1890s. You or I could ride what was then known as the safety bicycle, which is a bicycle with two wheels of equal size and a rear chain-driven wheel, no brakes, a fixed gear. And so we could ride that, and if somebody from the 1890s was transported forward to the present, they could ride the cool urban fixed gear of today. And also they would have the same facial hair as a urban hipster. So as we move into the 1890s, the limitation on this, the first great bike boom of American history, probably one among three or four, and we're in the third or the fourth right now, depending on how you count them. And this, the 1890s was the great bicycle boom. And the limitation was the roads were terrible. The roads are unpaved. They're not professionally engineered. They're mostly dirt or compacted roads outside of cities. And it's not like the automobile is the traffic pushing the bike out of the road. There are no automobiles of note. And so cyclists in this great all-consuming fad of the 1890s, as everyone, particularly the high-class elites, pick up bicycling as recreation, they're looking for a solution, how to create bicycles or roads for bicycles. And the first they come up with is what's known as the Good Roads Movement. And the Good Roads Movement is an example of great advertising and naming, because what really is a movement to convince Americans to pay for roads out of taxing themselves. But that doesn't sell as well as good roads, because before this point in time, roads are built by those who live or do business on them, the abutters, not out of general taxation. So the Good Roads Movement isn't going to have much success in the middle of the 1890s, and some cyclists turn to a separate plan, what they call the Side Path Movement, like a sidewalk, which had been built for pedestrians starting really in the middle of the 19th century in America. But a side path, a separate bicycle-specific network protected in state law with county-level commissions to collect first taxes and then later user fees, like a tag or some sort of NPR tote bag, perhaps, out of which those funds would be used to build bicycle-specific paths. The Side Path Movement had a great deal of success upstate New York, Rochester, building hundreds of miles, Minneapolis and St. Paul, hundreds of miles of Side Path networks, and states across the Union passing these Side Path laws. But as the bike boom faded, the user fees dried up, it would have been a disaster, except the Good Roads Movement was finally seeing some success, and cyclists were delighted because they thought, wow, we're going to have now these paved roads for our use. And automobiles weren't really numerous yet. So at that moment, side paths were simply paved over where they existed. And cyclists looked forward to a new shared paved road system that they would use in common with other road users. And then seems to be the conflict we've set up today.
We're talking right now with James Longhurst, author of the new book Bike Battles, about the history of cars and bikes and other vehicles sharing the road. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see happen to make everybody be able to use the road? Do you think we need to change the way we set up our roads? More amenities for bicyclists on the road, separate paths, bring back these side paths that our guest was just talking about. Whether you're a motorist, a cyclist, a little of both, like to know what you think. At 800-642-1234, that's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation, move into some modern day debates after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about bike battles, the history of cars and bikes sharing the American road. Cyclist and UW lacrosse professor James Longhurst is our guest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about cars and bicycles sharing the road, the current state of affairs? Is there enough room for everyone? Should cars be given priority? Do bikes need more things to help them out? What policies do you think can make the road safer for everyone? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Eric on the phone in Vilas County. Eric, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
And what do you think?
We've got a phenomenal set of paved bike paths up here in Vilas and Oneida County, and they're well complicated the issue a little bit because they're not really well suited for all types of biking. So we've got large groups of road bikers that will be out doing 18, 20 miles an hour. And there's a bike path right nearby that's being used by families with Fido and kids on tricycles. And the motorists therefore become almost a little more hostile towards folks that are using the roads within the legal parameters for riding in groups or riding in pace lines or just socially riding when the bike path is 30 feet off. They were stuck between being a hazard on the bike path and being a hazard on the road.
Eric, thanks a lot. Eric, thanks for the call. And James, he's bringing us up now to the 21st century. As you said, we're in the midst of a big bike boom. Are conflicts like the one Eric mentioned, gray areas like that, pretty common today?
Well, Eric brought us up to the 21st century. I'm immediately going to throw us backwards because as a historian, I think that what I can bring to understanding our current the nickname we have for this is the bike lash, that we're in the middle of this historic increase in cycling, both recreational and commuting. And at the same time, as we rebuild cities to respond to that, there's a backlash. Again, it's political, it's cultural, and we nickname it bike lash. But I'm gonna throw it backwards into history and say the division that Eric brings up is both between recreational and transportational cycling, and also between the ideas of separated versus combined infrastructure. And I'll do the cowardly historian's route and say we have had this discussion repeatedly. And in a lot of ways, I think one of the things I can say usefully as a historian to help us understand why the bike lash is so extreme, because it really kind of is unhinged. It's if you read the letters to the editor in a newspaper or the responses in a Facebook post or discussions about the return of the bicycle and the sharing of the public road, I think that debates over use of a shared resource would be expected. But we have some really extreme responses. And as a scholar, I wanted to understand why that is. And I think Eric's pointing us into this direction, that the fact that historically we've talked about bicycling as if it's one thing. And so if somebody responds in a letter to the editor and they say, well, bikers should do this, or I think the bike means this, or the bike is just this, quite often we're speaking different languages. Some people could be talking about recreational and highly skilled athletes in pace lines, and some people could be talking about 8-year-olds, and some people could be talking about a very expensive $10,000 full carbon frame, and some other people could be talking about a $25 Walmart bike, which is someone's lifeline and their only access to their work schedule or to a nearby grocery store. And yet somehow the word bicycle applies to all of these things: recreational, transportational, commuting, on-road, off-road, dirt bike, road bike, tricycle. And so this, I think, is one of the useful things I as a historian can do is point out that all this history has been rolled up and it's never quite clear what people are referring to when they have that discussion.
Well, looking at the lessons from history as we come near the end of the conversation, are there ideas here, this idea of a commons maybe, that can maybe not solve everything, but given the roadways we have now, make things work a little bit better, a little bit more civilly, and a little bit more safely?
Well, the positive thing I take about from talking about the commons is a lot of people who think about the commons think about the tragedy of the commons, the idea that we instinctively or overuse a shared resource. And more environmental scholars have been thinking, instead of the tragedy of the commons, about the triumph of the commons, that when you have a shared resource, human societies traditionally have figured out ways to deal with it. It takes some time. And one thing about the road as it is with the automobile on it, it's really only existed really in its current form for less than a century. And so we're still debating what that shared commons will be. I think that we probably will be able to share things better, mostly because I'm an optimist and I'd really not like to be run over, if that's at all a possibility, please.
Well, good luck with that as you cycle the rest of the summer away. James, thank you so much for sharing these stories with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's James Longhurst. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Bike Battles, A History of Sharing the American Road.